is also utilized as a spinal blockade. A couple of things. While both of these are generally associated with lumbar levels, with lumbar procedures, you can block as high as T2, that is thoracic vertebrae 2, or thoracic nerves 2. It's just that the higher you go, the greater the chance of CNS involvement, particularly in the medullary area. And of course, we've talked a little bit about the problems associated with too much local anesthesia in the medulla, and what that means particularly with autonomic functions like heart rate and blood pressure and those things. So it's much more common for us to put the injection in lower, like I say, usually in the lumbar area, and then through the use of two factors, we can, adjust the level of anesthesia that we observe. And the two factors that we utilize are body positioning, that is, we have often with these procedures a slightly head-down position, and the density of the anesthetic itself. That is, very commonly, the anesthetic is in a hyperbaric, almost a gel-like type of, dare I call it, solution, very thick. And as a result, when we inject it, if the head is tilted down, it will tend to slowly descend toward the head, or if you prefer, ascend up the spinal cord and start numbing levels up until you get to the point where you want it. Okay? So we can do that. That tends to be much easier with an epidural, much easier to control, but it can be done with the intrathecal or subarachnoid as well. All right, so just a couple of things. The popular block of an intrathecal or subarachnoid nature is known as the saddle block, and that is done at L2 to L5. Okay. Spinal cord is generally, in most people, going to end at about L2. And as a result, there is a fairly significant space between the end of the spinal cord itself and the end of the meninges, which generally don't end until C1, caudal 1, or caudal 2. And so you can get in underneath the meninges and with minimal risk to nicking the spinal cord itself or any of the major nerves that come out of the spinal cord. Because they're all going to be, as you might suspect, up in here, coming out up in here, and you're down in here. So, L2 to L5, intrathecal or subarachnoid block, you'll see very commonly called a saddle block because, generally speaking, unless, like I say, you maneuver the patient on the operating table or maneuver the solution as to how far up it gets, what is generally going to be numb is the, quote, saddle area. That is that part of the body that you would expect to contact the saddle, let's call it western saddle as opposed to eastern, cowboy saddle. It basically is just below the navel until upper thigh type of area, saddle block. very commonly used block for obstetrics, if we go with an intrathecal or subarachnoid nature. Now, as you might expect, a couple of issues, a couple of cautions with this type of block. One, you are puncturing a major defense of the spinal cord. Those meninges are there to keep bad things out, as well as to keep cerebral spinal fluid in, but infection becomes a real concern. And two, you are putting a hole in these meninges. Cerebral spinal fluid pressure tends to be a little bit higher than that of the space in and around the meninges. Not only is it naturally a bit higher, but what have you just added? A little extra volume, making it even greater. So it is not unusual. How's that for a nice double weasel? Not unusual. You pull the needle back out for there to be a little bit of an oil well gusher. And of course, what's right there that can be lost? The fluid you just put in. Okay. Not only that, but we may lose some cerebral spinal fluid as well. And these pressure variations very commonly get reflected in post-surgical headaches. Headaches become a very real issue here. Sometimes fairly short duration. Sometimes they can last for a significant period of time. Okay. And what is that, you ask? Well, I've heard of cases where it's months. Okay. Where a person is suffering from headaches because the CNS is still trying to get itself back together in terms of consistency, constancy of pressure. So by putting a hole in here, you have one, a high infection risk, and two, problems with cerebral spinal fluid pressure and or concentration of anesthetic that has gone in actually, as opposed to the epidural block where you are blocking outside. You don't have either of these issues. Of course, with the epidural block, the big issue is to get it across these meninges into the spinal cord itself. And as a result, most epidural block preparations are much higher concentrations of anesthetic. And there's always a tendency with these high concentrations, if you're not careful and you, instead of putting it epidural, you actually do puncture the meninges and put it subarachnoid or intrathecal, you're now doing it with a much higher dose and a much higher chance then not only of the infection, but also now you've got a high chance of overdose and all the associated issues that may be accompanying that. Epidural generally is much easier to do, much easier to accomplish. Historically, of course, now we have fluoroscopes and other types of imaging and monitoring equipment that have made the subarachnoid and intrathecal much easier to accomplish. But we still see both of them used quite commonly. There's a special name for a particular type of epidural. It's called a caudal. I've had two of them. Lots of fun. And you probably don't know. Just after the turn of the millennium, I had to have a hip replaced. I was generally, instead of a round ball and a round socket, I was a round socket and a square ball. And so I was pretty gimpy. And for a year, they kept treating me for lower back pain. God, I had some good stuff. Until it was a PA. It wasn't even a physician. I kept complaining. I said, it feels like I pulled my groin on that side constantly. She says, what groin pull? That means hip. So they went in, took some x-rays, sure enough, I'm walking around and I'm essentially no hip. Well, as part of the good stuff, for a year before that, I went to a pain clinic and they gave me a mix of narcotics and steroids and all sorts of good stuff. And they gave it to me through a caudal injection. Okay? As the name implies, instead of coming in from the side, you're going to come in from the end. There's a nice big sac, a hiatus, at the end of the spinal column, the bone, and the end of the meninges. Just like there's a space that I showed you between the end of the spinal cord and the end of the meninges, outside of that is a nice space as well, a space that will tend to keep the material in an enclosed area for a period of time. But to do that, they have a special table. They double you over, pass up, okay? And this needle is like, I mean, and it's kind of cute because it's a local anesthetic first, surface, then you can watch it on the fluoroscope. You know, watch your own ass. I mean, you're better than that. And you watch him come in with his needle into the skull, and do the injection. So, it's a particular type of epidural that's commonly employed for a number of different purposes. It's called a caudal injection, tail injection. Now, given that, then, let's just go back and briefly review the other two ways in which local anesthetics can be commonly used. Probably the most commonly used way in which we apply or use local anesthetics therapeutically is for surface anesthesia. Most all of us at one time or another have utilized a local anesthetic for its antipruritic activity. Not only are we stopping pain afferents, but we're stopping itch afferents as well. So for things like poison ivy or other dermatologic problems where itch becomes a big issue, commonly used local anesthetics. For mild, note the word, mild cases of burns, mild sunburn, where there's no skin damage to speak of, we also use local anesthesia to try and modify the pain. The big thing here to understand is that the local anesthetic, and I'm sure Dr. Bosch will get into this, is just a little bit different. Okay, we've got a couple of these compounds that tend to have a very difficult time crossing the dermal layer. Not the epiderm, but the dermal layer. And as a result, tend to stay localized at the surface, at the skin. Obviously, I say this for the reason that you don't want them underneath the skin, because they're going to cause all sorts of problems because of the way they're formulated. We want them at the surface, and that's why if you're going to use this type of compound, you know, you don't put the anti-itch compound on after you've dug your fingernails in and have drawn blood. Okay? You have to make sure when the people use the compound that they're using it correctly. Surface anesthesia. The other major surface anesthesia procedure is ophthalmology. After all, this is how local anesthetics got discovered, as you remember. Tonometry and other ophthalmologic procedures where you don't want a blink reflex or other things to disturb the diagnostics, you use a local anesthetic. A And then one other type that is utilized more and more for various outpatient procedures is what we call infiltration anesthesia. Here we're just below the surface, generally in the dermis or subcutaneous area. And we see this used a lot for minor wound stitching, and or dermatologists use this a lot for taking out moles or other surface types of procedures. So it's not truly surface, it's just beneath the surface, but it's truly not a true block from the fact that we're blocking axons or nerve bundles. We're actually still mostly blocking surface types of receptor preparations. Infiltration anesthesia. And as the name as you might understand, I said there were certain special compounds for surface anesthesia. For infiltration or block anesthesia, the compounds generally are distinguished mostly by duration of action. If you're going to be stitching up some wounds and it's going to take you 20 minutes, you don't want to put in a local anesthetic that has a duration of action of 8 or 10 hours. I've got this sheet. Before you panic, the faculty secretary has been out now all week. I'm still not sure whether it's she or whether it's one of her kids that have the flu, but anyhow, as soon as I can, I'll get this copy for you, because you're going to need it a week from Friday, right? A week from Friday. I have not received any threats or hate mail of any kind. So we are switching to a week from Friday. I may not get through all of the material to be covered, but I can modify, trust me. Okay, so it's a week from Friday. Now if I get hate mail, I'll just hate back, I guess. I don't know. Okay, week from Friday. But hopefully she'll be back in the next day or two and I can get this photocopied and out too. Okay? You know, it's mostly chemistry, but what I want you to look at is that right-hand column. There's a potency issue, but trust me, okay, all of these things are potent enough, otherwise they wouldn't be on the market. I mean, that's a no-brainer. You don't put a local anesthetic in and you say, what's the dose? Well, 10 ounces. Liquid ounces, that just doesn't happen. They're all potent enough. The big issue is duration of action. How long do you want it to, in fact, last for the procedure that you're utilizing it for? Okay, you don't want to put in an epidural for a procedure that's going to last 4 hours and a local anesthetic only lasts 30 minutes. The patient will get pretty pissed after a certain period of time. So that's what that's all about. And I'll get that to you as soon as possible. Some of the commonly used ones. Okay, so that's locals. Now, back here. Remember, we're up in this corner. General anesthetics. We're talking about general anesthesia. I've got two tag ends to fill in, and then we'll keep on going about general anesthesia. The first of these is the fact that, as you remember, we've developed a number of different volatile anesthetics. The reason is that none of them is perfect. Some of them are very good in certain situations, some in others, but they all tend to have little quirks, if you will, that tend to keep them from being universally used. But for whatever purpose we're using them, for the most part now, and probably for the last 40 or 50 years, the tendency has been, I don't care what the general anesthesia is that you're using, what you're going to do as a pre-op, pre-anesthetic procedure is you're going to use an inducing agent. We have utilized nitrous oxide for quite a period of time prior, but nitrous oxide had its issues. You remember the diffusion hypoxia, da-da-da-da-da. But a funny thing happens on the way to the store, if you will, and that's this. I was looking for this a little bit. I thought I had it. Take a look in here. Best laid plans of mice and men. Pharmacy professors. A little more chemistry, but the chemists can play in their area. Ready? This is a chemical structure we'll be talking about mostly on Friday. You'll notice that it's a six-member ring, and that it basically is two halves, two, three members. The left half, if we split it, of that line that the pen is pointing to, the left half is urea, as in urine, urea. The right half is a dicarboxylic acid, three carbons, the one we tend to be most commonly associated with at this point in your pharmacology career, is the four-carbon dicarboxylic acid known as succinic acid, i.e. a compound called succinylcholine that we use to block the neuromuscular junction. I'm seeing a lot of blank stares here, and that scares me. Do we remember succinylcholine? Is that in the memory bank somewhere? Okay. Succinic acid. Well, this is only three carbons, not four. And the name is malonic. M-A-L-O-N-I-C. Malonic acid. This ring structure is known, has become known then, as a malonyl urea. Malonyl ureas. And the common name for this structure, malonyl urea, is barbiturate. This is a barbiturate. Notice we've got the possibility of a couple of substitutions out here on the right. If one or more of those, well, if both of those are phenyl groups, we have what is known as phenobarbital. It's probably the most commonly used barbiturate at this point, but typical structure, fairly simple structure, barbiturate, okay? And was used for a long time, they were used for a long time for their sedative. Read that as anti-anxiety, anxiolytic, sedative, hypnotic qualities. Hypnosis, of course, being a sleep-like state. We'll talk about that little more in a few minutes, okay? Sedative hypnotic, that is dose dependent. That little continuum that I talked about a week ago, going down the line, you know, disinhibition, anxiolytic, sedative, hypnotic, all the way down. Well, we kind of figured as we're putting that together that you keep boosting the dose of barbiturate, where do you go? Anesthesia and then death. But the interesting thing was, as we started fooling around, not we, as drug manufacturers started fooling around with this basic ring structure, and why were they fooling around? They were basically trying to find therapeutic efficacy, either sedative or hypnotic, with a lot less side effects, toxic side effects. They started fooling around. One of the things that they did was that they substituted that oxygen, and one of the substitutions was a sulfur group, and a whole new class comes into being, generally called the thiobarbiturates. And the one that took off, that became the predominant player here, there were two or three that made it to market, but the one that became the predominant player is a compound called thiopental, or pentothal. Truth serum, it was popularly called in the 50s and 60s. But one of the things about thiopental is that it put a person down fairly quickly. And so in the mid-50s, it became also very popular as an inducing agent. And so we start seeing that the person's going into major surgery. The anesthesiologist comes first with a syringe. This stuff had to be given intravenously. I mean, that's almost a no-brainer. Why are we using this stuff? Speed. What's the speediest way to get something into the body? Bypass all absorption. Put it right into the system. The only way we could get it even speedier would be what? Bore a hole in there and just dump it in. Okay. Nah. A little too traumatic, so we give it intravenously. Okay? Thiopental, and it's the old, this has happened to me now a number of times. Count back from 100, and I can't seem to get past 97. Gone. Inducing agent. Okay? Thiopental. And as we'll see, barbiturates, thiopental among them, have some problems. Like I say, they tend to have some side effects, among them respiratory depression, big time. They're not something we would like to have to deal with if somebody's under anesthesia. There's some issues with nausea and that sort of thing. So we said, okay, this is a good start. Can we do better in terms of inducing agents? And two or three have been developed, come to the forefront. All of them, as you might suspect, have their little quirks. Amidate. Used for a while. It has minimal. Notice the word is not none, it is what? Minimal cardiovascular side effects. Minimal respiratory depression. That made it advantageous over barbiturate. Okay. Unfortunately, as opposed to barbiturate, it also has minimal neuromuscular relaxing qualities. So it made it more difficult to intubate. You know, one of the things with the gas anesthesia, as we got more familiar with it, is you put a tube down through the laryngeal area to get rid of that bronchospasm type of problem. You intubate a person and put the gas on that way rather than a whole mask. More difficult to intubate without a neuromuscular relaxant, so we had to throw another compound into the mix. And tended to have a higher incidence of nausea and vomiting than thiobarb. So it had two advantages in terms of autonomics and autonomic types of functions, but it had some disadvantages. So we keep going. The next one that becomes really popular is Diprovan, propofol. Okay, propofol. Pretty similar to thiopental, the barbiturate. It tended to have a more pronounced effect in terms of vascular resistance. It tended to go down a little bit, decrease. Tends to be a negative inotrope. So you can kind of read into that hypotension and be careful with that. The biggest thing about it, and the reason it became popular, and we'll talk about this on Friday as we get into the barbs, very commonly as you come back up, if you're using a barbiturate for hypnosis, for sleep, you have a what we call a post-icto, post-event, drugged feeling. Okay? Loggy, your mind isn't crystal clear, you kind of realize, God, I did take a drug yesterday, didn't I? And thiopental was famous for this. People would have problems in terms of coming back out of surgical anesthesia, in terms of getting their mental acuity back together. And propofol, none of that. So people would come off fairly clean, responsive, in good shape. So it was very popular. We just had to watch the hypotensive aspects of the compound. Oh, and another thing about this, it is still popularly used as well as the next compound. In producing what we call balanced anesthesia. Now, balanced anesthesia starts with nitrous oxide. And you notice I put it in quotes because when you get right down, push to shove, it is not true anesthesia. It's you Google this in to your whatever. I use Google. And you get thousands, literally, of different combinations. This is a general term, balanced anesthesia. There's no one set formula. You know, it's like you Google in chilling. And how many different recipes are you going to come up with? You know, anything from mild to, let's see if we can tear your stomach right out of your, you know, out of the chiller. Well, it's the same thing here. Recipes about every anesthesiologist or hospital, it seems, has their own pet combination. But generally, it revolves around, initially, nitrous oxide with a combination of a narcotic analgesic, an opioid compound, and a neuromuscular relaxer. And it was commonly utilized for what we would call office procedures. something maybe a little more involved than we're stitching a person up or removing a mole, but still didn't require a hospital operating theater to accomplish. Balance anesthesia. Thiopental takes the place of nitrous oxide in a lot of instances. It's kind of not only the inducing agent, but to get a person down fairly easily for a quick, short amount of time. Okay. Thiopental was found to have just too short a duration of action. Something, if I may forget it on Friday, could go back to whatever notes you got on thiopental. You put that S group on, nanomolurea, and its lipophilicity explodes, goes up tremendously. One of the reasons why we can use it for induction. You put it into the vein and it just goes across the blood-brain barrier like gangbusters. Okay? That's why I couldn't get past 97. I mean, it's that quick. The only way to get past 97 is to have them put it in a vein that I've taken out that's over by the door, and it's going to take a lot longer for my heart to get it to my brain. Because once it gets there, it's in. Okay?
Where was I going?
Oh. But just like it gets in easy, because of its high lipophilicity, the thiobarbs are one of the few compounds where their action is terminated by redistribution. They are the classic, the prototype. Very short duration of action because it gets in the lipid so easily. And a danger of using too much thiopental is once you saturate those lipid stores, its duration of action goes from minutes to hours and even days. And we have some issues with that. Okay, so thiopental replaces nitrous oxide. It's got problems. Diprivan replaces thiopental and becomes a mainstay of balanced anesthesia. But the compound that tends to be utilized most, well, I won't say most often, but commonly now, is a compound known as midazolam, and its trade name is Versed. Now, this is your first exposure in this class, at least. I think Dr. Lovstead said you, did she talk anxiolytics already? To this group of compounds, benzodiazepines. Okay. Midazolam was developed off of the benzodiazepine base to be an anxiolytic. Is it? Well, yeah, if you call knocking a person out, relieving their anxiety. Okay. And it does a good job. Midazolam or Versed is now used as pre-op, and it's also used in balanced anesthesia cocktails, recipes. Again, with opiate narcotics and neuromuscular relaxants. Why has it become popular? Greater than 50% of the individuals that take a dose of Versed have an amnesic episode. That is, they have trouble remembering the minutes and hours prior to surgery. Short-term amnesia. So we get an after-the-fact or anterograde amnesia of the whole experience. Generally, they'll remember coming to the hospital, that sort of thing, but after that, it gets, I won't say they completely lose it, but it gets kind of fuzzy, let's put it that way, up through a period of recovery. And this, you know, I say amnesia, don't confuse this with what I talked about in terms of a drug feeling. numbers bad, you just can't really remember what happened clearly. So it's become very popular for that reason. The one thing about it, and the reason that you may still see some anesthesiologists liking Diprovan, is it tends to prolong the recovery period from a number of general anesthetics. It tends to make them a little slower in terms of coming out of the anesthesia. Finally, for this morning, I got to mention a couple of other things. Other products. One of these is a compound called ketamine. Ketamine became very popular for about a decade, and what we called it was dissociative anesthesia. Ketamine as opposed to the other compounds that I've talked about, while at really high doses tends to be general in nature, but for the most part it is a little more selective type of compound. And it tends to start with the forebrain, with the cerebral cortex. It acts on the cortex and the limbic system at doses that don't really get to the reticular activating system and the medulla and those areas. And so we had a little bit different type of affair going here. It was called dissociative anesthesia. The person really wasn't anesthetized, but they were dissociated. Now, ketamine was developed, I'm not sure if that's true or not, so I better not say it. It's a close relative of a compound called phencyclidine, also known as PCP. If you're aware of that. Now, we're talking the 60s, early 70s here. What we're talking about basically is a compound that took you on a trip. Okay? You were in surgery, but your mind was out admiring the girls on the street or the mountains in Oregon or whatever. You were gone. Your cortex, your thinking and emotions were over on the wall, they weren't on the table. Dissociative. Ketamine, a good analgesic, not so good as a muscle relaxant. So generally we had to give a muscle relaxant with it. And because of its lack of lower brain activity, that is, little or no action on such things as heart, vasculature, respiration, it became very popular. The problem with ketamine is that it has a bad recovery. And I use bad in the sense that recovery may be in 2 or 3 hours, but for a lot of people, for a period of weeks, and some papers some cases, even months, of hallucinations, nightmares, PCP, well known for this. Well, ketamine's a bad boy, too. This tended to be more prominent in, well, with age. Let me put it that way. The older you are, the better the chance of this happening. The other major thing is, we found out with extended use, it has a tendency to increase cerebral spinal fluid pressure. And if you were dealing with a closed head injury or some sort of head trauma, tended to cause real problems there. I mentioned ketamine because it is still used in veterinary practice quite commonly. And so, I mean, there's many tales in northern Michigan. Somebody breaks into a veterinary office, what are they after? Trust me, it's not the rabbits. Okay? It's the ketamine. They want to go on a trip. What did I just say about what usually happens on the trip? The trip may be nice, but the, you know, the photos and the movies that you take afterwards may not be so nice. All right, we'll see how it goes.